The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark.
And we are delighted to welcome Ed Miliband, the latest contender for the Labour leadership, to grace the Politics Weekly studio.
And sitting next to him is a man who always makes it onto our ballot paper, the Observer's Nick Cohen.
So good day to one and all. Now, as is becoming a habit on this podcast, we're going to start with the very latest department to be cut.
The Central Office of Information, that's the one that's responsible for all the government adverts, is about to undergo a savage restructure.
Which could spell trouble for the department that brought us such classics as the 1975 infomercial Protect and Survive, featuring all you need to know about disposing of a body during a nuclear war.
If anyone dies while you are kept in your fallout room, move the body to another room in the house. Label the body with name and address, and cover it as tightly as possible in polythene, paper, sheets or blankets.
Nick, I'm sure you'll remember that. But do you
I do, I'm sorry to say, yes.
Do you welcome the kind of end of nannying and all the stuff about eating up your greens?
Well, I mean, it appeals to a very strong view in Toryism that you see in the Mail in particular, Simon Jenkins in our papers. You know that there are these endless panics of the government feeding, pying out information for scare stories that don't turn out to be true. And often they're right, you know, about the flu, or the Millennium Bug. Do you remember the Millennium Bug? One's a great waste of money. But I mean, sooner or later, there's going to be trouble and government's going to have to talk to the population. I'm not... No journalist is going to complain about government press officers being fired, I'm afraid.
No, no.
But it's very odd if they just fall for the sort of Jenkins view that, oh, it's always a fuss about nothing. Sometimes there isn't a fuss about nothing.
Do you remember it, Ed?
No, I don't remember it.
How old are you?
Actually,
I remember E.T. Thompson's protest book about it as well.
I would have to have been a very precocious 5-year-old to have remembered it.
Where does this leave this big Tory idea about nudge? You get rid of, which is the idea that you give people the right information and encourage them to do the right thing rather than spending big government money on big projects. What happens now if they're going to cut all the press offices?
I sort of think this is one of those things that you go on about in opposition when you're looking for areas that you say you're going to cut, which is what they did when they were in opposition. They used to go on about government advertising. I'm sort of amazed that they are making a big deal out of this, because actually a lot of this government advertising is about drink driving or about smoking and actually saves the government money. And it's the right thing to do. So without sounding too po-faced about it, I think there's a role for this. I'm sure you can look at how much you're spending, but I'm sure there's a role for it. And it's kind of moved on a long way, I think, from Protect and Survive.
One I really remember is just a few years later, this stuff about don't eat raw kidney beans or you'll die. It's sort of
That was on That's Life, wasn't it? I remember as a kid watching That's Life, and Esther Ranson used to go on and on about raw kidney beans.
Your department did an advert and you got censored for it, didn't you? It was too alarming about a kitten.
Climate change. It was quite scary. Actually, we didn't get censored.
You okayed it, didn't you?
We didn't get censored for the
kitten.
For the kitten, the drowning kitten. We used a particular fact in a particular way about climate change, but it basically upheld our view that you could say climate change was real and man-made and happening. It was about how likely there were to be storms or something. But I think there's a role for this, because look, why did we do that advert? Because only one in five people thought the next generation would be affected by climate change.
Do they any more think it after an advert like that? I mean, is it adverts that change?
I think
perception.
Adverts can help to raise perceptions. I mean, I don't think on its own it does it, but I think as part of a website and other information that you need to give out to people, I think there's a role for this. Because actually, you know, and part of the job of leadership, I know we're going to come on to this, is to sort of try and explain things better, because actually the fog of war, if you like, shrouds a lot of our political debate. So I actually think there's a case for this in the right circumstances.
It's an interesting example as well, because I think they said in amongst their other criticisms that it was too scary, but with climate change it kind of is too scary.
So yeah, and actually, to be fair, the ASA were on our side on scariness as the drowning cat.
Kind of necessary. Well, the coalition may be doing less nannying, but at the same time they are outsourcing Big Brother. Here's David Cameron this week setting out plans to get private credit check companies to work on benefit claimants.
1.5 billion is enough to pay for something like 40,000 nurses in the NHS. So it is wrong, and I want the government to cut this fraud out and also cut out the error and the waste in our benefit system too. And so Ian Duncan-Smith, the head of the Department of Work and Pensions, will be reporting back to me in the autumn about all the ways we can make sure we do this. Obviously, prosecuting those who commit benefit fraud. Obviously making people pay back the money. Obviously having tough penalties. But also using more modern and new methods to make sure we get to grips with benefit fraud, including using other companies and private sector companies and credit rating agencies and credit agencies to share information so we can go after those who are claiming it illegally and fraudulently. I think it's the least we can do as we try and get the budget deficit under control.
Nick, is he on to something, or is Big Brother back?
I think it's August, and I think that chap from the News of the World, whatever his name is, who didn't know his reporters were bugging people's phones.
Oh, Andy Coulson.
Yeah, I think he's made a grid, and he's cut down on benefit fraud in the second week of August to get a few headlines. I mean, you know, Brown
hold on,
did
there's
this,
a substantial
Blair
proposal
this.
Here, though. You're absolutely right, it's a silly season, but there's a substantial proposal that will be policy.
Well, I can't see any objection to it.
Really? Having people from private companies crawl all over benefit claimants are spending their money
But they do it anyway. You know, they do it when you apply for a credit card. It's just a...
But they're doing it differently, whether you're on benefits or whether you're not.
But also, I mean, it's a sign of how the centre in Britain just doesn't understand how little money most people in Britain live on. You know, most people on benefit, their benefit fraud is probably doing a couple of hours in a pub or doing some work in someone's garage. I'll be very interested to see what the results of all this are. I doubt you they're going to find the prisons are going to be full of convicted criminals from all of this.
Ed, the previous Labour government did use this in checking housing benefit claimants, so you can't fully dismiss it.
No, I'm with Nick on this. I think it's a sort of piece of posturing, which I don't know actually what the policy means in practice and how it's different from what was done before, but it's sort of let's try and create a headline about welfare fraud to convince people that we're being, you know, tough on this in order to prepare the way for big cuts in public services in the autumn. I think it is as cynical as that, and I think it does just make, let me make this point, I think it's what you see with this government, which is it's a combination of some posturing and then some pretty dramatic changes in the shape of government, in the shape of our society, which they try and sort of shroud and cloak in the posturing that they're engaging in.
Isn't there a bigger point here, though, which is that the coalition agreement makes much of getting rid of the Big Brother state, the database state, but here it's back and it's privatised. They're not so worried when it's a private company crawling over people's information.
But it's sort of they're all over the place. They also say in the coalition agreement, no top-down reorganisations of the NHS. And then they're engaging in a massive top-down reorganisation of the NHS. They say, let's give people a say over the things that matter to them. And they're abolishing public inquiries as part of their gerrymandering of the electoral system. I think it's partly that they have not got a really fully worked out programme, but I think it goes deeper than that. I think, in the end, I think it is about a big attempt to reshape our society, reshape the nature of the state and dramatically cut it back. And anything they can do towards that end, whether it's posturing about government advertising or posturing about welfare, they're going
to
do.
But what's interesting is that if you wanted to sort of, no offence to Ed, but break up the sort of rather centralised Labour Fabian state, what you do is give more power, including tax-raising powers, to local democracy, to local councils, where they would be accountable. As it is, I'm interested to see how much money they're going to save on this. They're giving a large amount of public money to private companies. You know, as a journalist, trying to get answers out of them is just impossible. How far ministers can be held to account for the spending of that money. It's not necessarily cutting the state, it's privatising, but it's still the public's money.
But Ed,
it's still
again, the welfare
money.
Reforms, that it doesn't seem from all the polling that the public were aware the Labour government did in the last few years before it left office. Again, they had a role for the same. Lord Freud advised James Purnell and he's now advising the Tories. So do you think those last 3 years were a mistake?
No, I'm less attacking the nature of this proposal, which I don't know the full details of, and more trying to draw attention to what is the most important thing, which is the bigger picture. Take another story this week, which is around the milk snatching business, you know, getting rid of free milk. Mm. Now, why did they U-turn on that proposal? Because they knew it would be a disaster and throwback to the 1970s and Mrs. Thatcher. But why was that proposal on the table? Because the message has gone out in Whitehall. The philosophy of this new government is starve the beast, what the American right calls starve the beast. You cut back the welfare state to being one full of holes and therefore further undermine support for it. And one of the ways you do that is convincing people that it's just full of fraud. Now, of course, you've got to tackle fraud and error. But I go back to where I started, which is where Nick started, which is, I think this is part of a strategy and a pretty dangerous strategy.
Well, let's just come on to Ed's campaign now. I mean, you know, the big issue for the next 5 years absolutely clearly is going to be tightening the belt of the government. You say you don't like them starving the beast. I think I've heard your brother say he wants to stick with the spending plans Alistair Darling had, which are very, very tight. Ed Balls is saying something different. Where are you on that? Should we be rewriting the spending plans that the last government had or not?
Ed Balls is suggesting possibly deficit reduction over 10 years.
Well, what I've said is two things. First of all, you've got to recognise that there is a very big difference between what we were proposing at the election and what they're proposing. We were proposing changes which I think meant overall about 10% reduction in spending across the board. They're proposing 20%. So it is a dramatic increase in scale and difference in timing because they're cutting this year, and we know that has dangerous implications. What I've said as the, if I'm the leader of the Labour Party, is I will look at the precise balance of taxation and spending within a deficit reduction plan, and I will indicate where we are on that by the time of the spending review on October the 20th.
But you must have feelings on that now.
Would you support things that would make you unpopular with Labour members, like, say, a public sector wage freeze?
Well, we had a proposal on public sector wages, which is to keep the pay bill, I think, going up at 1%. And I think that was the right proposal. I do want to say this. There's a distinction between being in government and being in opposition. And the dangers for oppositions is that you decide very early in a parliament, you decide to spell out every dot and comma of where you stand. My position is quite clear on this. Alistair Darling's plan is the starting point. It's a very different plan from that being proposed by George Osborne. But I think just like you look at everything when you lose an election, you look at that as well, and the precise balance between taxation and spending in particular.
You must have a feeling, you said it's a starting point, so you're suggesting possibly
Well, I think we need to look at the balance between tax and spending, for example.
It's 2-1. Right,
Well, that's what we need to look at because, for example, there are things I think you can do on the banking sector, taxation on the banking sector, for example, where I think the government said we're going to take $2 billion off the banking sector, but then essentially gave it back in a corporation tax cut. I think the banking sector could probably bear more than our plan suggested at the election. Well, either in terms of a banking levy or the bonus tax, but one way or another, I think they could it could bear more.
You might be right that you're going to be able to keep a bit of ambiguity, and maybe that's a good thing for an opposition to have about exactly where you'd come down. But there's a tonal thing, isn't there, that's going to be crucial for the next Labour leader, which is, do you set up to defend and oppose most of the cuts that are coming forward? Or are you going to say, well, yes, we will increase the, I don't know, the pension age, which is one of the things they're doing, but no, we don't
look at them on their merits. Look, let me be very clear about this. We are not going to, if I'm the leader, we're not going to oppose every cut, because if you oppose every cut, we won't be credible.
Which cuts would you, can you?
Well, they haven't announced. They haven't announced their cuts yet.
Trust Fund. I mean, would you keep that?
Well, we would have kept that because they've come along and abolished it. But if you're asking me in 5 years' time, am I going to restore the Child Trust Fund? I'm not going to give you an answer on that now, and I wouldn't be a sensible person if I did. Look, let's be clear about this. They're going to come along with their comprehensive spending review on October the 20th. It is right that as a political party, we have a clear response to that. One thing that I'm saying very, very clearly is that the scale of cuts that they are proposing is far bigger than we would have proposed. I also think they've got the balance between taxation and spending wrong. And I think that's important. And I think that is a clear difference.
What's your feeling about the idea that Trident might fall almost between the two budgets of the Treasury and Ministry of Defence, such that we could have this thing that was a huge ideological debate in Parliament about whether or not it should be renewed, now falling foul of costing?
Well, I don't think Trident should be excluded from a look at what is right to spend in the future. The big decision on Trident takes place in 2014-15, which is to spend £1.5 to £2 billion a year for the following 10 years. And I think it's right for us, anyway, speaking for ourselves, that we look at whether Trident is the right deterrent. I'm not a unilateralist, so I believe we need a minimum deterrent. But whether Trident is the right deterrent and what scale any deterrent needs to be at. And I think you shouldn't exclude that from the spending decisions that we will be making as an opposition.
Why should you exclude having a deterrent at all if you're having an open-minded review? Why wouldn't
because
you look at that question?
Because I think that the 1970 nuclear non-proliferation treaty recognises us as a nuclear power. Actually, multilateral disarmament is going well, or better than it has done under President Obama. And I think we should be part of that, but multilaterally.
You're not going to make yourself unpopular in the Labour Party by proposing taxes on bankers or maybe replacing Trident with something cheaper. Do you accept, if you're leader, you're going to just get, you and your colleagues will get this day in, day out. What would you do? What would you do because of the scale of the public debts? And to just say, well, we're in opposition, we don't have to, we can do a bit of fancy footwork, it's going to be pretty brutal.
But
for
I'm not
you.
Saying we've got to do fancy footwork. I'm saying we had a clear alternative plan at the election. That is my starting point. But I think it's right that we look again at the precise balance between taxation and spending, for example, as part of that plan. But I think it's very different from the scale of cuts that are being proposed by the coalition.
Now, one of the novelties for the next Labour leader is going to be trying to figure out how to fight the double-headed beast that the party now finds itself up against. An extraordinary sight this week was the joint press conference between the Tory Saeed Wasi and Chris Huhne. Here they are.
The truth is that Gordon Brown tried to buy the general election. Labour's big spender went on a hell of a bender. It was goodbye prudence and hello hangover.
One of the great things about this coalition government is that we're delivering the bulk of the Conservative manifesto with the best of the Liberal Democrat. And it's my role as Conservative Party chairman to continue that thinking, that Conservative thinking, that development of Conservative policy. And at the next election, as Chris has said, to present to the country the record of the coalition government and Conservative philosophy and thinking.
Now, when you listen to that, Ed, are you thinking that you need to treat the Liberal Democrats as prodigal progressives or as traitors who've totally sold the past to the Tories?
I'm thinking it's time to go back on holiday, frankly. What can you say? I think that in the end, it's the Lib Dems who are in a bigger crisis over this coalition, clearly, because they have betrayed many of the things that people thought they stood for and that they said at the election. And this is a different strand of the Lib Dems. I think Chris Huhne and Nick Clegg represent, and this has become clear, a much more conservative brand of liberal democracy. Indeed, I'm not surprised that Clegg and Cameron are getting on well because they are both small state people. Small state in terms of civil liberties, small state in terms of the economy. And I think in the end that may split them apart, actually, the Liberal Democrats.
You can see the logic of politics pushing the Liberal Democrats further and further into conservative embrace. I mean, it's partly, the anger on left or progressive, whatever we're meant to call it these days, at them. And so people like Chris Huhne, who's very cocksure, as you could hear, they're not the kind of people who say we've made a terrible mistake, and they just the more they attack, the more they go over onto the conservative side. The psychology of it is very interesting. But I do wonder where they're going to end up. It's all very well, Ed. I mean, it's quite interesting what you say, because I'm one of the many Fleet Street journalists who failed to look at the Lib Dems properly. And when you do read what they say, they are very, on economics, they are free market, small state, more so than many Conservatives, actually, who still want Trident and strong law and order and everything.
So, Edward, do you think in the next 5 years, a Labour Party run by you could preside over the second part of the realignment of British politics, getting the dejected Lib Dems?
I think that we can become a home, certainly for dejected Liberal Democrats. Voters.
What would it look like in that situation? Would you have the end of the Lib Dems and they would join the Labour Party, or would you have some would join the Tory Party?
I think they may just decline and then fray. I mean, it may be that they hold together for the coming election and just do very badly. But I think a lot of Liberal Democrat voters, as you see from the polls, will want to come to us, but only if we present the right offer to them, which I think is progressive on economic policy, but also small L liberal in relation to civil liberties and other things, where I think we got the balance wrong. And I think that is a different identity from the last 10 years that I'm talking about for the Labour Party.
But one of the things unhappy Lib Dems won't like about what Labour's doing at the moment is the possibility that it will vote against the AV bill.
Yeah, but let's be clear about this AV bill. This is not an AV bill. This is a gerrymandering bill with AV thrown in. And it would be completely irresponsible for us when we know that it is gerrymandering the parliamentary boundaries, it is short-circuiting the timetable, it is disenfranchising 3.5 million people, and it is abolishing public inquiries, which have existed for more than 60 years. I've been in Cornwall, where people are outraged that they're going to be shoved into another seat. It would be completely irresponsible for us not to oppose this bill, frankly.
So a Labour Party run by you would oppose, if they don't drop the boundary change, would oppose AV?
Would oppose the bill, right.
Yeah.
I'm also Allegra. I mean... AV is a motherless child. It's an orphan. Yeah. No one actually believes in it.
I believe in it.
Well, yeah, I'm wondering about people on The Guardian. When they realise that under certain circumstances...
I wonder that all the time, Nick.
Yeah, right. Under circumstances, you know, in 1997, it would have produced an even bigger Labour majority than first past the post. I mean, it's not... Who's going to go around selling this? I mean, obviously, Labour is. Who's going to go around town halls and public meetings speaking from the heart, saying, you know, like, one, stuff rejects us and vote for women? Well, no, Nick Clegg doesn't believe in it.
Would you get all your shadow cabinet to line up and support this?
1975 is the best lesson for us, which is that people take their own positions on a referendum.
But, I mean, if you want to hug these dissident Lib Dems close, you need to look like you're on the right side.
I think
side
most people in the shadow cabinet do support it. That's my, from discussions that we've had in the past, I think most people are broad supporters of AV. But let's see whether, let's come to a referendum when we come to it. But I'll certainly be supporting AV in a referendum if it happens.
And another issue where dissident Lib Dems will be looking for different mood music from you, I guess, is Iraq. And it's, of course, now several years in the past, but we've had news this week that Americans planning to pull out. How far are you prepared to go in saying that this wasn't just something that cost trust, but this was a catastrophic error?
Oh, I've said it's a catastrophic loss of trust for us. I think
I know you've said that. I've said, are you prepared to say it was a bad thing?
It was an error, yes, yeah. I think the lessons of this are a couple of things. I think, first of all, when you... I'm not against liberal intervention because I supported Sierra Leone, Kosovo, and I support what we're doing in Afghanistan.
Did you support the Iraq war or did you oppose it?
No, I opposed it.
How did you make your opposition known? Did you go on demos?
I didn't go on demos, no.
Talk to journalists? I mean, it seems a very quiet opposition, sort of invisible
opposition. Well, talk to anyone who was talking to me in 2003, 2004, and my views were very clear, and I made my views very clear. I was also working for Gordon Brown at the time. But I think the real issue about Iraq is not so much who was right and who was wrong. It's, do you now draw the right lessons from it? And the right lessons from it, for me, are a couple of things. First of all, you've got to ensure that when you go to war, it is genuinely a last resort. And in the case of Iraq, Hans Blix was saying we should be given longer. Secondly, you've got to build an international coalition and a broad-based coalition, which we did actually in relation to these other conflicts that I talked about.
What would be your attitude if your leader, and Iran, it's pretty clear, next year gets a bomb? What would be your attitude to Labour's attitude under your leadership to some kind of attack on Iran?
I'm not going to speculate about that. I think we're doing the right thing in relation to Iran, the international community, which is a twin-track process of negotiations with the threat of sanctions. And I think that is the right way to go on this. And it's a tricky, it's a difficult situation, but I'm not going to start speculating about military action against Iran.
Do you think negotiations with sanctions are working?
Well, I think there's some evidence that, you know, it's the best card that the international community can play, in my view.
Handbrake turn. Unite back to you to be Labour leader, but they've just announced that they're going to be sanctioning the closure of 3 and 6 airports later this month. People will have their holidays destroyed. What's your message to them?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that I think that strikes should always be a last resort. And I hope that the unions and the employers get round the table to seek to resolve this before it comes to industrial action. I think the second thing, though, I would say is that politicians engaging in megaphone diplomacy on these issues is not actually conducive to them being sorted out.
Are you doing some mobile phone diplomacy then?
No, I've come straight from my holiday to speak to you. No, look, it's for them, really. I mean, we've got to get away from the idea that if politicians can make a difference to the settlement of a dispute, they should do so. But the truth is that this is a matter for the unions and employers to sort out, and I hope very much it's sorted out before people's holiday plans are disrupted.
Do you think it's harder to adopt that pose, though, for a Labour Party, which retains very deep links with the trade unions? You're going to be very dependent on them for money. And as Allegra's just said, you personally are kind of dependent on them for an endorsement at the moment.
Not dependent anymore.
What do you mean? Is it harder for it to us to
well to keep neutral? I mean, you're going to face institutional pressure from within the Labour Party that, say, a Liberal Democrat or a Conservative government.
Look, in a way, this is why we've got to change the culture of British politics. I mean, if the idea is that unions are simply the perception that people want to create is that unions are simply about strikes and that unions are not a cornerstone of a civilized society. Well, I'm sorry, I disagree with that. And actually, the fact that we have only 15% of people in the private sector workforce in trade unions is bad for them and bad for our society. Now, you know, industrial action, it must always be a last resort. And I think that's a very important message. And I think most sensible trade unionists, all sensible trade unionists, recognize that. But, you know, I'm sort of, I think we've got to get away from the view that we're about to Well, the caricature that there is about the fact that union members across the country have backed me for leader, because I think it's just sort of, I think trade unions are playing an important part in our society.
Now, we're going to turn to our visual aid that we're steadily building for our readers and listeners when they're making their mind up, if they're Labour members, about who they're going to vote for. We have a swingometer on which the people that have already been on this august podcast have already put themselves on a left-to-right spectrum of the Labour Party. And for listeners and readers, we've got on the left, Diane Abbott is really quite high up there on the left, ding, ding, ding. And then we've got Ed Balls is next. And then Andy Burnham, well, he hedged his bets and put himself economics. He's slightly to the left, but social. He's slightly to the right. Come on, Ed.
I'm going to be a spool sport.
You are. I knew you'd try to be.
You even came in.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to care.
But why not? I'm not
going to engage in your sort of simplistic diagram. Yeah,
why is it simplistic? Ed,
Labour members who I meet and talk to, they say, if they're voting for you, I say, well why are they voting for you rather than for David? They say, oh, but Ed's more left wing. But you don't seem prepared to say that with the aid of this wonderful,
Let me make this point. I think that the reason why the media has been bored by this contest, or some of the parts of the media, I'm not saying you guys, is that we haven't taken lumps out of each other, and we've characterised our own candidacies rather than trying to caricature others. I speak for myself. Ask me any question about where I stand on the issues, and I will tell you. But it's for other candidates to say where they stand on the political spectrum.
They have.
The question is whether you want it.
Good luck to them.
Ed Miliband, that is very disappointing.
You're staying here. You're staying in this room. We're not letting you out until you make a mark on that graph.
Well, the others can do this straight.
You know where talking. I've said very clearly in this interview where I am, which is that...
Okay,
I think
Ed, how about this? Do you regard yourself as more left-wing than your brother?
I speak for my own candidacy. He speaks for his candidacy. And I think that's a very important part of this contest, which is that we say where we stand on the issues, and then people make a judgment. How would I characterise my candidacy? Most of all, as recognising that the new Labour playbook of the past is not going to work in the future. We have a different electoral map. We've got a different policy agenda we need to pursue. We've got a significant vote among lower income people that we lost and we need to win back, and we need to have a different attitude towards our party. But I think to reduce it to a caricature of who's more left wing or who's more right wing, I think frankly doesn't help the debate.
Okay. Just to help with the subtlety, we'll give you the two options that
you make. You can make your decision.
Okay, well, thanks to Nick Cohen, but not thanks to everyone. And that is all we have time for this week. Politics Weekly was produced by Phil Maynard. I'm Allegra Stratton.
I'm Tom Clark, and goodbye.
Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.